Just so you don't feel completely lost, one of the basic themes we're looking at is how the Hebrew scripture contains two different religions, two different ways of binding people together as a people in the name of Yahweh, in competition with each other. One referred to as the religion of empire, which has its focus on a Jerusalem-centered, imperially sponsored, hierarchical, violently enforced regime. And the other, religion of creation, is grounded in the experience of God the Creator in the creation, in communion with other people, in table fellowship, and sees all peoples as family and sees the earth's gifts as to be shared among all people rather than to be hoarded by some or gained by some at the expense and exploitation of others. So we've been looking at a few passages of that, and today we're going to be focusing on chapter 12 and 13, which will provide an example of each side of that dichotomy. So, and if you noticed, we're videotaping the first part. You're not starting yet, are you? Yeah, but you'll edit this part out, right? We're videotaping the first part of this simply because my publisher asked for a little video clip they could use for a promotional thing. So, you know, you're not going to be on it unless you want to be on it, I guess. It's just going to be for about 15 minutes or so, and then we'll just continue. Okay? So, can you start the recording from here, or is there somebody else in the cosmic sphere here? All right. So as we get started this morning, we left yesterday with the Tower of Babel in the verses just above what we see on the screen. Here we go, in Genesis 11, where God had scattered all the people who had been seeking to make a name for themselves by building this city and tower. And then we get into another one of these genealogies. And as we've looked at both in chapter 5 and here, to our way of reading, this seems boring and usually irrelevant, and we skip over it. And I'm not going to spend much time on it. But to highlight one of the ways that Genesis is trying to create a transition between the generation after the flood, after, as we saw yesterday in chapter 6, that tragic moment where God, the text says, God regretted having made human beings, and it grieved God's heart. Because humans, rather than multiplying and filling the earth with life, had filled it with violence. Then seeks to make this new start by kind of wiping the slate clean for the flood. But as the text shows, it's not effective. Because soon thereafter, we get, as we saw in chapter 10 yesterday, Nimrod, who creates a counter beginning. In Genesis 10:10, the beginning of Nimrod's kingdom, and it's in the plain of Shinar, and of course it's Babylon and the surrounding empire. And so we're faced with this ongoing situation where although God made everything good and made humans very good and we're all one family and all the earth is good and all its creatures are good, human beings have taken it upon ourselves to make a counter world. An alternative world to God's world. And that's what's shown in the Nimrod story. And it's what I call generically empire. It had the form of city-states in the ancient world, but if we were to reflect on what form empire takes in our world, it wouldn't be city-states. A couple of people were concerned when we were talking about the origin of the city in Genesis 4 with the building by Cain. Are you saying all our cities are evil? Well, no. Because a city in the 21st century is not the same kind of thing a city was in the ancient world. You know, cities are not run, for example, by kings, as far as I know. You know, they're not socially hierarchical in a rigid sort of way. They're not bounded by a wall. They, you know, cities themselves don't have separation of us and them. You know, obviously anybody can move freely in and out of cities, et cetera, et cetera. So, it's not cities that are really the focus. It's this wider phenomenon called empire, which is this, you know, system of human domination over other people and over the earth. So it once was cities. It later, as we know, became elements of what we call Christendom. In the more recent world, it's been nation states, one might argue, as I did with my co-author in our book on Revelation a decade ago, that today the provenance of empire is in global corporations, and that nation states are doing the will of corporations rather than the other way around. Mm-hmm. And you can agree or disagree, but the point is it's not cities today so much that are in control of creating that kind of world. So after the Tower of Babel, there's this the generations of Shem, who, as I showed briefly yesterday, and I can remind you of today on the map, let's see. I lost my cursor here. There it is. So just going back a little bit here. Here we see the world is divided by the generations of Noah. And so the Shemites are in that area there in the Arabian Peninsula. But Babylon is in the middle, the city-states that make up the Empire of Babylon. And so that's where our story picks up. And while I'm on the map, let me draw attention to a little bit closer to where we're going here. And so we have here this journey that, as we'll look at in a moment, is started by someone named Abram's father, Terah, out of Ur of the Chaldeans down here, within the city-state region of the Empire of Babylon. And they go to this place called Haran up here, which is on the western edge of the area controlled by the Babylonians, on their way, for reasons that aren't named, to a place called Canaan, which, of course, is the general area we know now as Israel. So that descendants of the Shemites here goes through the series of names and ends up, as we see down here, with a focus on Terah. So what happens here in Genesis is we go from what scholars call the primeval history, this history from before anything of named people that can relate to anything like historical that we might identify with, you know, the beginning, to a story that then follows one family and its descendants throughout the rest of this book. It's God's solution to the problem of empire, to the problem of Nimrod's kingdom. And so we'll focus both on how this connects back with what we looked at yesterday with the Tower of Babel and how it looks forward to a narrative that we will only look at one more time tomorrow as we look at the question of hospitality in chapters 18 and 19. So one of the interesting things about how Genesis uses numbers, and we mentioned yesterday in the genealogy in chapter 5 that amongst the list of names of people with lots of years of life was one person that was different, Enoch, who it said, you know, was taken up to God and was no more, and this sort of mysterious departure that apparently wasn't death. Did anybody remember yesterday how long he lived? 365 years. So highlighting the solar calendar and the solar year that was so important to the Israelites over against the lunar year of the Babylonians. Well, an interesting thing with numbers here is if you were to count the number of years from the first child born after the flood to when Abraham ends up in the land of Canaan, guess how many it is?
365.
I already said the answer. 365. So we're not taught to pay that kind of close attention to the numbers, but that's one of the things that when you do look closely, you can see. So it's 365 years from the first child born after the flood to when Abram at that time gets to the land. Now again, this is not chronology in the historical sense. This is not the way fundamentalists would take it to be, you know, actual years that you could measure such that you can count how old the earth is. It's symbolic numbers. There are two things, broadly speaking, I'd say about symbols in the Bible. And I think this is pretty true. There are no non-symbolic trees. All trees in the Bible are symbolic. And there are no non-symbolic numbers. Numbers in the Bible are not counting devices. They're expressions of theological meaning. Whether that's 666, you know, or the 40 years in the wilderness, or Jesus 40 days in the desert, or when Jesus offers that mysterious math problem to the disciples in Mark's gospel. Do you remember how many loaves Well, how many baskets of fragments were left when I fed the 5,000? 12. And remember how many baskets of fragments were left when I fed the 4,000? 7. Now do you understand? And think about the next scene. Well, Jesus is counting on, unsuccessfully at that moment, the disciples to understand how biblical numbers work. So there are no non-symbolic numbers and no non-symbolic trees. Hence, of course, in the Garden of Eden, Eve does not eat an apple, but a fruit of the knowledge of good and evil tree, which is the point. Okay, so the numbers here are not expressing, you know, chronology as much as they are God's presence amidst this transition from the empire builders to an alternative. And there's a lot of details that we could get into. I really encourage some of you who've talked to me in between about discovering, perhaps for the first time, of how much more there was in the Bible than you thought. There's a lot more than we're going to possibly get to right now. Every one of these verses here is crucial, and every word is crucial. So I'm just going to focus on a couple of the verses up close and just invite you to pay more attention to the details as you go. So Terah has three sons. As we see in verse 27, Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Haran is the name of the city where they are, and the name of the father of Terah, and the name of one of his sons. Haran died before his father Terah in the land of his birth in Ur of the Chaldeans. Excuse me. So Abram and Nahor took wives, and of course we know about Sarai. And then we're told this fact that, of course, you already know. Sarai was barren. She had no child. And so on it goes, and Terah, it says, lived to be 205 years, and he died. But if we pay close attention, we recognize that's about the future. He's not dead now at 205, if we calculate the years. In fact, he's alive for most of the rest of Abram's life. Abram lives to be 175. If you want to do a little math problem, and I'll give you the answer tomorrow, find the pattern in the death ages of the three patriarchs. Abraham was 175, Isaac was 180, and Jacob was 147. And there's a little math problem there, and I'll tell you the answer tomorrow. If you're leaving today, send me an email. Okay, so Terah is alive the whole time, which is to say Abram leaves Terah behind in Haran and goes on. Now, we don't know why Terah left Ur and went to Haran on his way to Canaan. How does he know where Canaan is? It's not like he does what we do, like I see people doing in the hotel in the morning, looking on the map, you know, to decide where you want to hike today. You know, people had never seen pictures of places they'd never been. And if you lived in Ur, a city of the Babylonian Empire, how would you even know there was a place called Canaan? And how would you know how to get there? Well, of course, the way to get anywhere, as you see on the map, is to follow the river. So this map shows, you know, the following of the Euphrates here, because you wouldn't go this way, would you? You know, just across the bare desert. Any more than the Romans in the time of Jesus went across the Mediterranean. They hugged the shore, being terrified of the idea of going out into the middle of the ocean and losing track of land. So similarly, if you went out and lost track of where the water was in a desert place. So they follow the river, and we don't know why. But they stop in Haran. And Abram, again for reasons we don't know, is ready for something else. And then we get to what are three of the most important and really most amazing verses in the entire Bible. So we would need to look at this really closely. So in verse 1 of chapter 12, then the Lord, Yahweh, said to Abram, go, and I'll just read this translation and then I'll note some details. From your country, your kindred, and your father's house to the land that I will show you, I will make of you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you, I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So Abram went as the Lord had told him. That's an astounding scene. Let me open up a little bit of why it's so astounding. Does, according to the story, Abram know who's talking?
God.
How does Abram know that? You know that as a reader. The reader's told, the Lord said to Abram. But when the quote starts, all Abram hears is some voice that says, go. That doesn't identify itself. How does Abram know whose voice that is? How would a Babylonian know who Yahweh was anyway? Even if it said, I'm Yahweh. You know, when Moses ends up at the burning bush in Exodus 3 and has this encounter, take off your sandals, you're on sacred ground, and he says, who are you? He says, I'm Yahweh, the God of your ancestors, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Okay, there's a reference point. But what's a reference point for Abram? You know, he's from a land where they worship Marduk and all the other pantheon of gods and goddesses of the Babylonians. They don't know anybody named Yahweh. And anyway, the text doesn't say who it is to him. How do we envision this happening? It's not like, say, apparently, Jesus' baptism in Mark 1 in parallels, where it says, the heavens were split open and the Spirit came down like a dove and there's this voice, you know, a lot of cosmic apocalyptic fireworks. Like Paul on the road to Damascus in Acts 9. Same kind of thing, and there's a blinding light and a big sound, and people thought it was thunder and all that kind of stuff. There's no cosmic fireworks here. There's no, the heavens are split open. There's no lightning. It's not like at Mount Sinai in Exodus, where there's smoke and fire at the top of the mountains, and the people go, you go, Moses, it's too scary for us. You know, it's not like the Transfiguration in the Synoptic Gospels, where Jesus is suddenly, you know, clothes are whiter than any fuller could make them, and they're full of God's glory, and they can all see it, and, you know, it's just this voice.
I think he just felt compelled to do that.
Precisely.
I had times in my life I felt compelled to do something, and it was afterwards I knew why I was compelled.
Yeah, exactly. So, you notice he doesn't ask any questions. He doesn't say, hello? Who is that? Like when Bill Cosby does the Noah story, you know, you remember that? It's the Lord, Noah. Yeah, right. You know, he doesn't ask who it is, but exactly as you're saying, he trusts that this is the voice to trust. I wonder how he convinced Sarai. We're going, dear. Where are we going? I don't know. We'll know it when we get there. Why? I heard this voice. Who was it? I don't know. Right? What would he have said? But they go. And let's look more closely at the detail. This translation says country, and that's very misleading. Because, for a couple of reasons. First of all, they've already left whatever you might think of as their country. If the word country is a relevant word for the ancient world at all, which I don't think it is. The Hebrew there is eretz, which simply means land. It's the same word that's translated in the first part of the quote country as in the later part of the verse land. Same Hebrew word. So the point is to leave your land and your kindred, which is the word related to genealogy or generations. So it's an increasingly specific series of leavings. So from the land, then to the kind of genealogical association you have with a certain set of people, and then from your father's house, the Bayit Ab, which was the basic unit of society for people who were tribal nomads. So father's house meant father, not like the nuclear family of our world, of course, the father and the mother and any living relatives who were with you and slaves, if you had them, as it turns out he does have, and your animals, etc. So to leave all three of those to the land that I will show you. And I will make of you a great nation. And the word for nation here is the Hebrew goy, which later becomes the definition of the people who aren't Israelites. In plural, the goyim, often translated in English as Gentiles. As opposed to being an ab, which is a family, a people. An am, rather, a people. Ab is brother, which comes up also here. So, I will make of you a great goy, and bless you, make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. Now, for those of you who were here yesterday and we looked at the Tower of Babel story, how is this the opposite of what we heard yesterday about names? Remember the Tower of Babel of whose name was going to be great, made great and how?
They want to make a name for themselves.
Make a name for themselves. And how are they going to do that, Warren? How is their name going to be made great?
They're going to build this tower.
Yeah. So we're, in other words, we're going to rearrange creation in our own image, and that will make our name great. Remember, it said they bricked bricks, or they made bricks, and it said they had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. So not even taking God's own creation, the stones, but they made up artificial stones to create an artificial mountain to make their name great. Culture, you might say. And here is the opposite. I, Yahweh, Creator God, this voice from inside, as Sue's been leading us in the spiritual formation, spiritual practices part, that, you know, that light within all people, will make Abram's name great. And will be a blessing. And I mentioned briefly earlier when we talked about the garden story, but it's in fact when we talked about Genesis 1, but just to repeat it for now, blessing and curse have to do with, in Hebrew, barakah and aror, have to do with the path that leads to life or the path that leads to death. So to say that you will be a blessing is to say people will find life through you. In verse 3, there's actually two different words. The one who curses you, I will curse. The second word for curse is aror, which is what the curse was as punishment in the garden story in chapter 3. The first word for curse is much more like an insult or a denigration. So in other words, literally what it is to make small. So the one who makes you small, you know, I will prevent from being fertile. That's a cumbersome way to put it, but that's what's being conveyed there. Okay. In other words, people who don't recognize that what's happening in and through Abram is God at work will find themselves on the path to death. Those who recognize that what's animating Abram's whole life and path is the Creator God will share in that life. Okay, so Abraham is being invited to be the paradigm of encounter with God that leads to life. Okay. And so so Abram went and was 75 years old. And he took Sarai and his brother's son Lot and all the possessions they had, and they went to the land of Canaan. And it tells us they passed through a number of places, starting Shechem, and then to Bethel, as we see there in verse 8 highlighted in red. And mostly we skip those things because we think, so what, you know. And in fact, the text doesn't say why Abram went to those particular places. And I'm not going to get into this in great detail, but I'd like to just note the Bethel one just as an example of what's at stake in the book of Genesis. So as we explored earlier in the week, my argument is that the book of Genesis was written in the time of Babylonian exile. Earlier scholars who looked at these texts, this one in particular, and called it a so-called J or Yahwist text, would present that time of composition as being during the time of the peak of the monarchy during Solomon's era. And I think it makes no sense at all in the deeper arguments in the book, and or ask me some other time. But for the purpose of right now, highlighting that if it's at the time of exile, then the monarchy's all in the past. So the memory of what Bethel was in the eyes of the monarchy is in the minds of the audience of Genesis. And to King Josiah, one of the last kings of the Jerusalem monarchy, Bethel was the site of all evil. How many of you have heard of Josiah? Some. Half maybe. No. Josiah is not someone we think about that much, and I'm not going to take a lot of time. But according to the author of the books of Kings, Josiah was the greatest of all kings. There was never a king before or a king after that was as great as Josiah. Not David, not Solomon, but Josiah. And that's a story in itself, and I've got a whole chapter in the book on that. We won't get into it now. But Josiah, among other things, was focused in the 7th century, a couple of generations before the Babylonians came and destroyed Jerusalem, with what's nominally referred to as, quote-unquote, reform, religious reform. What it in fact was a campaign of destruction and murder, according to the text in 2 Kings 22 and 23. And it was focused on destroying everything and everybody who would not submit to the idea and practice that Jerusalem was the only acceptable place to worship. Bethel was just outside of Jerusalem and had been a place of worship for the Israelites, which to say the kingdom separated from Judah, for hundreds of years. And Josiah, quote unquote again, succeeded in doing what his predecessors are criticized for not doing, which is finally destroying Bethel and every evidence of worship in that place. It's not that they were worshiping other gods, it's they were worshiping outside of Jerusalem. As I was discussing briefly with the folks at the eye-opener this morning, you know, much like until Vatican II, the Catholic Church thought about Protestants. It's not that the Catholic Church thought the Protestants were worshiping some other Lord than Jesus. It's just you weren't in the Catholic Church, and that you might as well have been pagans. Right? Outside the church, no salvation, and it meant Roman Catholic Church, not the broad sense of church. Fortunately, at Vatican II, there's been a little loosening of that, but don't officially try to come to communion, you know? So, we can relate to that sense that, you know, to worship in a different place for some people is tantamount to worshiping another god. That's what's at issue here. And yet this text just quietly says, but Abram was there. He built an altar to Yahweh there and invoked the name of Yahweh there. And he goes back there later too. And so does Jacob. In fact, that's exactly where it says Jacob had the wrestling encounter. And what he says when he wakes up from that midnight-long wrestling, he says, God was in this place and I didn't know it. What would that sound like to the upholders of the Jerusalem Orthodoxy? The Jacob, Mr. Israel, after all, you know, the ancestor of them all, said, God was in Bethel and I didn't know it. I didn't know it because the Jerusalem people told me not, right? Not Jacob, but, you know, the audience. So very quietly in some of these details, the text is associating Abram, later Abraham, of course, with these various places that the Jerusalem-centered people found to be anathema. Okay? Abram is not a perfect person, you know? And one of the beautiful things about Genesis, and really about the whole Bible, is it doesn't present even the people that we think of as heroes or models as perfect. Lord knows Jesus' disciples like are clueless, you know, totally clueless all the way through until the experience of the resurrection. So even though Abram is incredibly practicing what Sue's been calling holy obedience and listening to this inner voice, the challenge comes when there's a famine in the land, in verse 10. One can suggest, and I think it's key to the Bible, that the central religious question in the Bible and beyond isn't, is there a God? The central religious question is, who do you trust for food? That's what you believe in. That's who your God is where you turn for food. Right? I mean, that's the challenge of the Israelites in the Exodus. Right? You know, Pharaoh's chariots and charioteers foolishly rush into the sea and they celebrate the death and they go, where's the food? Let's go back to Egypt. We know there's food in Egypt. And then Moses says to Yahweh, what am I going to do with this people you gave me, this rebellious people? And, you know, I'll provide them food, don't worry. And they get manna, and after a while they go, we're sick of this stupid manna. Right? Where's the garlic? Where's the leeks? We want ketchup. You know? Right? So the question of food is so central. It's obviously central to the gospel. You know, and one of the key questions of food is, does it require empire and its systems to provide it? Or do we trust that the Creator God provides food? We looked at the other day at the Eden story, and the Eden story is about God saying, I give you the trees for food. But people want to take control and have agriculture, which is the curse on the man in Genesis 3. So this tension is all the way through the Bible, from beginning to end. about food. We can, you can go to church and you can say you believe in Jesus, but if you go to Safeway, you believe in the global economy. Which means, as I was talking to someone at breakfast this morning, it's a practical matter, we're polytheists. We do believe in God, but we also believe in capitalism. Yeah, national security, and various other gods, and maybe goddesses, I don't know. So Abram's facing this problem here. So there's a famine. Famine is always a function of empire. It's not that the earth stops being fertile, it's that a particular place is having an issue. And it's only experiences famine if you can't move around to where the food is. You know, it's a closed system on this planet, right? If there's not rain in one place, then there rains somewhere else. I mean, it's got to rain. It's a closed system. So people are truly migratory people have the choice of saying, okay, there's not rain here, but we'll go to where there's food. And historically, in the ancient world, that's, of course, what people did. And so in this moment of choice, Abram goes down to Egypt. And, of course, we won't look at the story in detail, but what he does immediately is offer his wife as a sacrifice to save his own rear end. Right? I mean, that's what he says. You know, say you're my sister, it'll go well with me because of you, so that my life may be spared on your account. Which is to say, he's offering his wife to be part of Pharaoh's harem to save his own life. Not one of the proudest moments of celebrating Abraham, is it? And in fact, the story wonderfully says Pharaoh gets it more than Abram does. Right? Pharaoh understands that the bad things that are happening because of, you know, Sarah, Abram's wife. And then Pharaoh asks Abram a series of wonderful rhetorical questions that Abram doesn't answer. And says, get out of here. So Abram goes. And that leads us to the other half of what I'd like to do today. And again, feel free to jump in if you have questions or comments along the way. I know I'm only hitting some highlights, but I want to kind of illustrate the choice, and then we can open it up for more discussion. So, we see starting in chapter 13, verse 2, Abram was very rich in livestock and silver and gold. He's what to us is an oxymoron. He's a wealthy homeless person. He has no home. But he's rich. And he goes again back to Bethel and back to these other places, and Lot along with him. And then we see the scene starting in verse 6, which has so much resonance for our world if we look at it closely. And the literal Hebrew, again, as we saw with the Cain story, shows the earth participating in God's creation and this whole situation, at least metaphorically, more than we normally would do. The earth is clearly a character in the Bible. So in the Cain story, God says, the earth has swallowed up the blood of your brother, opened its mouth to swallow the blood of your brother, and I hear the blood crying out from the ground. So here, this says the land could not support both of them, but literally it cannot carry them. So it's picturing the land carrying these people and all their possessions, and it's too heavy. The word for possessions were so great there is the word kabod, which in Hebrew means both weightiness and glory. And we could explore that some other time, of the relationship between weightiness and glory. But it's basically saying the land's groaning that it's too heavy. These people are too heavy to all be in one place. And then it results in strife between the herders of Abram's livestock and the herders of Lot's livestock. And you might wonder, how can they have separate herders? Aren't they uncle and nephew here? Like, how can they, there's two separate groups within, aren't they just one family? But Lot's not exactly the hero of the story. So Abram says to Lot, let there be no strife between you and me, between your herders and my herders, for we are kindred. Okay? Highlighting that point that apparently must have been lost in the establishing of separate, you know, rivalries here. Okay? And now for Abram as the older man and, you know, the patriarch within this little traveling group, to offer the younger person the choice of land is an incredibly magnanimous position. You pick, Lot, whatever you want to do, I'll go the other way. Now, everything in the social norm would say, you know, I'm going to stay here, you go find some other place to be. But that's not what happens. And so he says, separate yourself. If you take the left hand, I'll go to the right, etc. And verse 10 is so important here. Lot looked about him and saw that the plain of the Jordan was well watered everywhere, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt. In the direction of Zoar, this was before the Lord had destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. So Lot chose for himself all the plain of the Jordan, and Lot journeyed eastward. Thus they separated from each other. Okay. What jumps out at you in verses 10 and 11 about how Lot makes his choice?
Well, it's eastward.
It's what?
It's eastward.
It's eastward, which we've already seen in Genesis, the wrong direction to be going.
Where the water is. Best land.
It's what?
Water.
Water. And is that a bad thing?
No.
Makes perfect sense to settle where there's a lot of water, doesn't it? What else do you notice?
It's also choosing Sodom and Gomorrah.
Sodom and Gomorrah, yeah. Before, so bringing that, if it was the musical background, you'd hear the, you know, the deep music go up there before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah.
Rather than taking the creation story, he's taking the domination.
Yeah, what are you hearing in that, Dave? How is Lot taking the domination story? I mean, he's doing what makes perfect sense, isn't he? He looks out and goes, there's plenty of water here. It looks like a nice, looks like the garden of the Lord. That's a good choice, isn't it? The place that looks like the garden of the Lord.
He's trusting himself.
He's trusting himself. Exactly right. He's looking out with his own eyes and making what any of us would think was a very reasonable prudential judgment. Which is, of course, exactly the prudential judgment that anybody would take. Which is why in the very next chapter there's war. And Abram has to hire a mercenary army to go rescue his nephew. The only time Abraham ever acts with violence. Lot is doing exactly what we would do on our own. Looking around and saying, this looks like a nice place to settle. There's water. There's other people. Wouldn't be alone here. There's some kind of social security with, you know, there's a town, so we're protected from enemies. Makes perfect sense. You know, one of the things with the curse, with agriculture that leads to cities, according to Genesis, is, you know, that agriculture has to be defended. You know, if you're eating the food that God provides, you don't have to defend this orchard or this hunting land. If somebody else comes along, you just move on. That's what Abram does in later parts when there's a dispute over wells and some of his opponents try to get at him by putting dirt in their wells. He just says, we'll just go on somewhere else. I'm not invested in staying in this place. If there's going to be strife here and you're going to make a big thing about it, I'm not going to fight you for these wells. I'm just going to go on somewhere. There's plenty of room. But when you have agriculture, you defend it. Because you're invested in it, right? It's yours. You know, if someone else comes along and says, well, what a wonderful wheat crop. Let's take that. Are you going to say, sure, help yourselves. We've been keeping the insects off and keeping the water on and everything for the last 4 months here. But you, sure, you go ahead and just walk right in and take it. Not likely, is it? I mean, let's make it more real for us. Someone goes, wow, you have a nice savings account. I think I'll help myself to it. Not likely, huh? Jack, you have a comment?
Yes, we have a great example of just what you're saying. Now, back out behind there is the Golden Village Garden. And it is heavily fenced to keep out the chipmunks, the squirrels, and deer.
And even though at Holden we can hardly imagine someone who walked in and picked a piece of basil or something being slapped on the finger for it, you know, Holden is obviously not the real world in that way. We're not relying on our food for that garden. You know, our food's not on a boat. So, you know, this is not the real world in that sense. Agriculture requires defending land. Defending land involves violence. That's what cities were for. was to provide walls that protected us from them and kept them out from getting access to our food supply. Which is why there's a war in the next scene between, it says, five kings and four kings, local city-state kings battling over the territory. The well-watered plain is always what people think is good, which is why they're willing to fight for it. You know, so when we pick what's good in our eyes, we better be willing to defend it with the way you have to defend those kinds of things. That's why we have a national security state, right? Well, that's why most Americans would quickly trade and are trading, you know, supposedly what makes this country different are constitutional freedoms in exchange for national security. Much rather have safety than freedom, despite the rhetoric of freedom, you know, that isn't serious. It's just rhetoric. So all that's rooted in this scene here. But immediately after Lot goes, then Abram encounters Yahweh again. You know, after Lot had separated, raise your eyes now and look from the place where you are, northward and southward and eastward and westward, for all the land that you see I will give to you and to your offspring forever. I will make your offspring like the dust of the earth, so that if one can count the dust of the earth, your offspring also can be counted. So Abram moved his tent and came and settled by the oaks of Mamre, which are at Hebron, and there he built an altar to the Lord. So we have established here, right at the beginning, these two different ways of journeying through life. One is grounded in listening for or watching for an experience of the Creator God to guide us in a direction. And the other is just looking out and deciding what looks good to us.
Verse 15, for all the land that you see I will give you.
Yeah.
Sounds to me like God is creating nationhood.
Yeah, and certainly this text has been used among others to justify the modern state of Israel and
or,
things
or
like
the
that.
The notion of state in general.
Well, what do you mean? What do you hear when you say state in general? What does that comprise?
Well, back to your notion of cityhood and protect the asset and be sure that you have sufficient food supply for your people and the like.
But notice
that is there something contradictory here?
Yeah, but notice that that's not what Yahweh says here. It's not establishing a state. It's not establishing borders even. You know, there are places like in the book of Joshua, for example. And in the monarchy story, where there's verbal descriptions of borders.
Well, but all that you can see suggests linear limits. What do you mean by border?
Well, for example, as I say in Joshua, it says from you get the land from here to here, and they get the land from there to there.
And it's bounds. Okay.
And it describes actual boundaries. You know, from the river, from this river to that mountain.
Okay.
You know.
So
and
15 is vague in that regard.
It's purposely vague. And when it says, I give it to you, we have to go back and look back at what the initial promise was, to keep it in its narrative context here. Back to chapter 12. And that's why every detail of this matters. Where am I here? That all the families of the earth shall be blessed in you.
I will make of you a great nation.
And all the families of the earth shall be blessed in you. That's the end of the sentence here. It's actually one sentence in Hebrew. So, the great nation will become something that all the families of the earth participate in. You know, this is not the Israelites as such. And quite plainly so, if we were to look at the bigger picture of Genesis, which we won't look at now, but since you raised the question, in the religion of empire-centered view of Israel's gift from God and inheritance, the Israelites are the holy people, and the other inhabitants of the land are not. The Canaanites are not. And according to Joshua, it's holy war. Right, you're supposed to, in God's name, destroy them all, and they fail at it, which is the reason within that narrative of why the monarchy is required, because you can't do it without a king with to generate a big army and then wipe them out that way. But it's us Israelites against the Canaanites. But in Genesis, first of all, in Genesis 1, everybody's family. In this particular set of stories, people like the Ishmaelites and the Edomites are part of Abraham's family. The Edomites, who are a great enemy from the perspective of the monarchy, are kin. And the potential hostile moment, which this text completely undermines, you know, Esau is Edom. It says twice in Genesis that exact sentence, Esau is Edom. So Esau being Jacob's twin brother, who, according to the understanding which the text immediately undermines, because he's like a few minutes older, he ought to get the big inheritance. And then there's the whole thing with tricking Isaac with the goat skins and all that stuff. That's a whole other story. An interesting one, but anyway. And so the text tells us that after Jacob apparently tricks Isaac out of the blessing, it says Esau consoled himself with the thought of killing his brother. And so their mom says to Jacob, you better get out of here. Go to my brother Laban's place in the old country until your brother cools off. Okay. And so he goes to Laban. You probably know the story. Meets Rachel at the well, and you know, and he has to take Leah too. It's a two-for-one deal. And you know, so they get married, they have a bunch of kids, and Laban, the tricky old Mesopotamian, keeps changing the terms of the deal until he finally says to his wives, you know, you see what a conniving so-and-so your father is? You know, he's never going to let us out of here. We have to just go. And they say, you're right, let's go. And so he goes, and then he hears word, your brother Esau's on the road ahead of you. And he thinks, oh, shit. And so... He sends the family ahead, and he has that experience at the River Jabbok where he has this wrestling. And is he wrestling with a man? Is he wrestling with an angel? Is he wrestling with the spirit of his brother? Anyway, so he comes out of the wrestling and he goes out there, and he's, what he basically tried to do is appease Esau. He sends presents and all the stuff, and he sends the kids first and the wives, and then finally they get there, and he's like, oh, my Lord Esau, my Lord Esau. And Esau says, my brother, it's good to see you. And he says, I'm sorry I took the birthright. And he says, no problem. I've been blessed too. It's all good. Want a journey with me? And Jacob says, thanks, but no thanks. He says, okay. So Esau, who embodies the Edomites, could have been presented as, and then there was war between the Israelites and the Edomites. And Jacob and Esau battled over it. But instead, it shows the Edomites, Esau, saying, we're all kin here. It's all good. There's enough room for both of us. There's enough stuff for all of us here. No problem. That so undermines the sense that the Israelites have priority to the land, and that God is only with them. You know, that's set up earlier, of course, in this narrative, when Sarai at that point is jealous of the fact that the Egyptian slave girl that came along with the prize package that Pharaoh gave to get them out of there is now pregnant, and it says, and Sarah looked small in Hagar's eyes. And so Sarah says, you get her out of here. And Abram says, yes, dear. You know, and sends them out. And as far as you'd expect, and he expects, they're going to die. But what happens to Hagar and Ishmael? Yahweh finds them and provides them water, and they live, and Ishmael's prosperous. So this text continues to undermine the sense that this promise is exclusive. What it's naming is, yes, there's all this land is for everybody who is willing to live in the way that you're living. There's plenty of room. It's not supporting anywhere that this is for some group called the Israelites to the exclusion of everybody else. And so we don't see anything like a state. And in fact, as we'll look at tomorrow when we look at the story of the three visitors who come to Abraham and Sarah under this very tree, the oak of Mamre that we saw at the end of chapter 13, we'll see that in contrast with Sodom. And we'll explore a little bit more closely what sodomy really is. It's not what it's been claimed to be.
But there seems to still be an ambiguity of place. It's important, and yet it's not important.
Yes, exactly right.
That's exactly right. If the wells don't work, we can move somewhere else. On the other hand, this is the place I'm giving you. This,
as far as you can see. Yeah. And you're right. And Genesis is not the gospel of Jesus. You know, Jesus does take that a step further, you know, and says, you know, there is no special place at all. This text isn't going that far. It's calling them out of the city-state empire of Babylon into this wide place. But, you know, when we look at a map, like here, and we see, you know, things on a map that look like they have definition, you know, in these places, you know, that's a kind of our, what a 20th century writer, Benedict Anderson, in a very helpful book, if you don't know it, called Imagined Communities, called, what's it called? Now that I've cited him, I'm forgetting his exact term. Logo nationalism, which is to say, people identifying where they live by seeing the shape of it on a map. So if I say United States, can't you? You can picture it, can't you? Even though those lines on a map are obviously artificial distinctions in the North American continent, you know, the Canadian border, the Mexican border, and of course throughout American history, it wasn't always that exact line, of course. So we're used to picturing countries on a map. That's a 19th century phenomenon and beyond. In fact, one that is actually, many wars have resulted because people, especially in Africa, people had lines drawn for them on a map by colonial empires and then started to defend that territory, even though their ancestors, you know, it was from this river to that mountain, rather than some line the British drew on the map of Africa. So when we look at these places, we have to recognize this is like desert. You know, what's a literally a line in the sand doesn't mean anything. So, you know, and I like this map because it doesn't show you any boundaries. It shows you there are these little cities, you know, mapped out along there. But other than that, it's just wide open space.
Well, it isn't the place that Abraham was given being with God?
Ultimately, yes. Yeah, and that's the bottom line. But because of it, I think we need to discuss this because of the history of Israel and because of other texts in the Bible, these questions of is there a promised land that has boundaries that's ours and therefore not the Palestinians? I mean, that's the real issue today. You know, it's Jewish and not Muslim, say, even though many Palestinians, of course, are Christians, you know. You know, in this time period, those were not the questions. And even empires, you know, when I showed you that earlier map, one reason I wanted to show you that was to say the Babylonian Empire is a network of city-states. It's not like it's a nation-state the way we think of it here. So here's the old Babylonian kingdom, you know, the one that would have been before the so-called Neo-Babylonian kingdom. The one, this is from the second and third millennium BCE rather than the one that destroyed Jerusalem and sent them into exile. You know, it's a few city-states out in the big open space connected by trade routes. You know, the thing that really made empire an empire in the ancient world, including Rome, were trade routes, not borders that could be protected with military. So they didn't care about the borders. They cared about protecting the trade routes. Okay. Wonderful question, though. Others? Other questions on the Abraham and Lot story and these and the question of the two paths here?
Seems like you're suggesting that Abraham is developing a pattern of non-confrontation.
Yeah.
You know, both with Sarai, and getting rid of, you know, Hagar, and, you know, not confronting Lot, not confronting the Pharaoh. I mean, he's just kind of a river that finds a way to the sea.
Yeah, although, as I've already noted, and as obvious to anybody who reads it at all carefully, you know, he's not perfect. It's not that we're to say, do exactly what Abraham did. You know, you're not supposed to be selling out your wife to the Pharaoh. Right? And so he's a human being, grappling with it. But when he stops to listen for God and starts to learn what following this God's way is like, it's exactly as you're saying. And so, again, in a passage we won't look at, but near the very end of the story, after Sarah dies, he has a very real problem of where am I going to bury her? I don't own any land here. And, you know, and of course it's an immediate question. Because a dead body in the hot sun, you got to deal with.
So these are interesting problems, or an interesting thing for a people that's in exile.
Yeah, and so what he does, anybody know how he finds a burial spot for Sarah? Well, there's a whole chapter devoted to it.
He bargains for it.
Yeah, he buys it. He uses some of that silver and gold he's got and makes a deal with the locals, who, in a wonderful story that shows kind of Middle Eastern bartering, you know, double talk and triple talk going on, because it sounds like they're saying, sure, take it. And he says, no, please. I thought they said they'd go ahead and take it, but it's a lot trickier than that. And they know that they've got time on their side. Right? He's going to buy a piece of this land. And the longer we wait, the more he's going to pay for it. So that's what they're holding him hostage for, is the, sadly, the, you know, melting body of his wife, you know. And so, but he buys it. He doesn't engage in a war to conquer them and take it. You know, we see that horribly later in Genesis, when that's what two of Jacob's sons decide to do to make up for the rape of their sister. In Genesis 34. A hideous chapter that presents exactly what's at issue here. Where Dinah, if you know the story at all, Dinah goes out and is raped by the son of the local king, Shechem. And then the son decides he wants to marry her. And although it's nice fiction, the novel The Red Tent wrongly conveys this as a love story that is thwarted by the family, like it's some ancient Romeo and Juliet. And it's clearly, in its context, not that. It's, you know, can negotiations make up for violence? And there's a split within Jacob's family. And so if you know the story, or if you don't know the story, I guess, they say, let's offer them this deal that we'll let their daughters marry our daughters, and we'll exchange animals, and the only deal is they have to have their men circumcised. You know, and they say, okay. And then while they're healing from the circumcision, Jacob's sons go and slaughter them all. Yeah, it's funny in a certain way, isn't it? and all the animals, too. You know, and Jacob says, you've made my name stink around here. So now we're going to have to move on. You know, Jacob's original plan was just to settle next to those people and to say, okay, the Shechemites can live there and we'll live here, and now we got to leave. Because you had to get violent vengeance. And of course, how often do we get violent vengeance? What's the response of 9/11 about it? Violent vengeance in the name of Yahweh, you know? But this text, you know, the bigger text of Genesis says, I don't think that's a good plan for the long term here. And of course, Yahweh's nowhere in sight in that story. There's no sense of any of that's being directed by Yahweh is telling them to do that. It's just them acting on their own with very human desire for vengeance. We can't let them get away with our, you know, isn't it reasonable? They raped our sister, so we'll kill them all. It was very reasonable in that world. And still is in some places, you know, that's the whole people are at issue. When their king's son did that, then their whole people's, you know, have to be destroyed. Why did we bomb Baghdad after all?
They're innocent acting people. Like Lamech, though.
What's that?
They're acting like Lamech.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. A nice catch from Genesis 4 that we looked at yesterday, the descendant of Cain who wants 77-fold vengeance, which, of course, is reversed in Jesus' sense of forgive 77 times. So this text presents some of those real issues, but whenever people act that way, Yahweh is not part of the story. When Abram's listening to Yahweh, he engages in things that are negotiations, or he lets the violence go by and does something else, and trusts that he doesn't have to fight for it. Okay. A last comment or question?
Yeah. Well, Yahweh seems to be okay with destroying Sodom and Gomorrah and the whole world.
That's our theme tomorrow. Yeah. You bet. There are consequences. Just like with Egypt. Just like with fallen Babylon in Revelation 18, which the Sodom story is the antecedent for. You know, explicitly so. It says Jerusalem. In Revelation 18, Jerusalem is like Egypt or Sodom. So, you know, those are the two major antecedents for the fall of Babylon metaphorically in Revelation 18. Yeah, there, and so we'll look at that tomorrow, but there are consequences. The part of the religion of creation in the Hebrew scripture does not say that everything's good and everybody lives happily ever after. It says that we can experience the Creator's presence and thereby know how the Creator wants us to live. And if we listen to that and obey it, life on earth will be heaven. And if we don't, it will be hell. And when we experience it as hell, then maybe we should go back and pay attention to listen to the Creator's voice telling us how to make it heaven again. Rather than going, God, life on earth is just hell. Right? That's just the way life is on earth. No, it's not just the way life is on earth. It's the way life is on earth when we're not listening to God. And so those very difficult texts like in Leviticus 26 or in the Deuteronomic parallel to that, you know, keep saying, these are the bad things that are going to happen. And if you continue not to listen to me, it's going to get worse. And if you continue not to listen to me, but any time along the way, you can stop doing that and go, I guess we should be listening to God. You know, I mentioned this, you know, earlier, I think, in this series, and then we'll stop. You know, a writer, I think, gets to the heart of what our American impulse is to say, this isn't working, let's do it harder. Like if we just keep trying really hard to do something that's not working, maybe it'll have a different outcome rather than lead us to hell that much faster. So again, I'm not just trying to promote my beloved wife's sessions here, but I think that's why we're doing Genesis and spiritual practices, because the way that this text is telling us to be faithful is to know how to listen to that voice and gladly respond to it. That voice that's available to Abram, who's an ordinary Mesopotamian after all, nobody's special, and to you and me. So thank you very much. I hope we can continue this tomorrow with chapter 18 and 19.
What do you make of...